Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Academic scholarships are automatically offered to eligible students upon admission, and all Luther students receive some form of financial aid. Luther.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org.
Nick, tell us about True Detective. How would you describe the basic premise of the show?
I think I would say it's a story that uses the popular genre of police investigation to conduct a more nuanced metaphysical investigation into its characters and their world.
Wow.
That's probably about as well. It's like my one sentence pitch.
Yes. So I mean, this is so interesting because you're using, in a way, the conventions of the crime procedural. I mean, the whole business of trying to track down the killer, without really quite fitting into that genre.
Thank you. I think that was definitely one of the basic structural goals of the series, was to use the machinery of the procedural to get at what interests me, which is the dissection of character and motivation and a world vision that can encompass those things and reflect them.
And for a show that is ostensibly about searching for a serial killer, there aren't that many dead bodies, and the killer almost seems incidental at times, which is pretty unusual for a crime show, I would think.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think that's just an expression of the show's values, which were sort of my values. In as far as what I was interested in, it's the horror that lies in the everyday, you know, not just in the interpersonal betrayals that might occur or the illusions we cast over who we are, but in the situations and environment depicted. You know, there's a way, and I think this is right, that in True Detective, the world itself is the crime.
What do you mean by that, the world itself is the crime?
Well, I mean that these two men and their world are a coagulation of history, of historical crimes and culture. And they are both subject to it and perpetuating it. They're its inheritors and its progenitors. And the world is a reflection of the characters, and the characters are a reflection of the world. One of the functions of all the granular details in background and in setting is to suggest this corruption at the root of the world, this poisoned garden, right? And what it suggests is that the world itself is poisoned, and there's something ruinous at work here. And the poison at the root of the world is humanity, which is also its only vehicle for meaning.
Humanity has somehow corrupted the world?
It's a chicken and the egg type thing. The world is a reflection of who we are. And our values and our concerns, however, we're all born into situations we didn't create, and inheritors of situations we didn't create. So we're also subject to these things. You know, in some ways, I go back to the first story I ever heard was a noir story called The Book of Genesis. You know,
you call that a noir story.
Well, you know, if you just think about it, there's sex, there's palace intrigue, there's sexual betrayal, there's vengeance, and then there's two brothers and one of them kills the other one. And this is the first two pages. That's the first two pages. So it's always been suggested in our oldest literature that we're living after some kind of spiritual or metaphysical fall. Correct? And there are these areas of landscape that seem to, in our own country, not to mention all over the world, that seem particularly illustrative of that.
Well, and there's violence at least an atmosphere of violence that permeates True Detective. I mean, obviously there's the murder sort of at the center of the story, but even, you know, more than that, your two main characters, the two detectives, are they're violent men.
I mean, they're violent men.
They live in a violent world, and it plays out in their personal relationships. It plays out in the social structures that you see around and at the police station. Are you trying to draw parallels between sort of that everyday level of violence and then the violent crime that they're investigating?
Absolutely. Well, the parallels right off the bat are between emotional violence, the violence of broken trusts, and the physical violence enacted on women and children in the background of the series, sort of just off screen. That's what everyone's averting their eyes to, right? And the layering of detail, the density, I would say, of detail and dialogue and character beats and themes are all in the service of this vision of a malignant world born out of culture, as though culture were the falcon in the widening gyre, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's out of control and it's now piloting us. And so you have characters engaged in enacting the roles they have never thought beyond, while simultaneously trying to deal with the consequences of the world those roles have wrought.
And the suggestion is that violence is part of particularly this culture of masculinity in this part of Louisiana along the
Yeah, Bayou. I mean, you know, so much of this is where I'm from. These places we photographed are all places I know. And I graduated LSU. I was 22, and that was the first time I left Louisiana. So I was in South Louisiana for the first 22 years of my life, and I have a complicated relationship to it. And so much about it has haunted me from my youngest days. But there was always a consistent language of violence, at least when I was coming of age and growing up. It didn't have to be the kind of life-threatening, ultimately evil violence that we suggest in the show. Sometimes it was just a shortcut for communication. But the physical and the threat of the physical was something that was always apparent. And I think that is probably common anywhere you have a large population of largely powerless people living inside a system and under structures that they don't understand and haven't seen the benefit of.
Well, and your two main characters, your heroes, or maybe they're anti-heroes. I'm not exactly sure. I'll call them heroes.
I consider them heroes myself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think they're very flawed human beings and each has extreme flaws, but at the end of the day, they don't avert their eyes. And they discharge their duty, and they're willing to put themselves in harm's way to service some idea, however archaic and inappropriate, of absolute justice.
So at one point, Marty Hart asks his partner, Rust Cole, do you ever wonder if you're a bad man? And Rust replies, the world needs bad men. We keep the other bad men from the door. Do you think that's true?
I think there's dangerous people in the world, and the dangerous people are often called upon to combat them. I think from the men I know and the police I've talked to, it's an old adage that there's a very thin line between a good cop and a good criminal. They share a lot of the same traits, a brashness, a boldness, a tenaciousness, an egotism to some degree, an obsessiveness. You know, the simplest argument is fight fire with fire, but I think Cole's point goes more towards Cole wouldn't say anybody wasn't a bad man. And in that respect, they're necessary to balance out the scales. Again, we go back to the world being portrayed. And so if the world discharges figures like this, you would be better off having a man like Cole, for instance, in the service of law and order than its opposite.
Yeah. Basically, I mean, the idea is it's a hard world and you need hard men to deal
with it. Well, not even, you know, and in my estimation, it's not even to deal with it, but it's to protect the things that aren't hard.
Yeah.
You know, protect the things that are worth protecting.
There's another theme that I would say runs throughout True Detective, and it's about how we construct narratives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're constantly going back and forth in time between 1995, when these detectives first get on this case investigating this murder, and then 17 years later in 2012, after both have left the police force, they're talking about what happened. They're describing what happened all those years ago, and we're not sure whether we should believe them. Why did you construct the story this way?
For a few reasons. One, it served my interests in the dissection of character and motivation. It was illustrative and in service of one of my governing themes, which is the inescapability of the past. You know, that Faulkner line that the past isn't over, it isn't even past. I've always felt that to be true. And if there was a way to juxtapose those things against one another, and to use the idea of the interrogation, the police interrogation, it's another trope, right? But we're going to use it as a vehicle to dissect narrative and motivation and character. And, you know, what you see in the show is never a lie. The guys lie a few times when they're in that room, but what you see is never a lie. So I thought, again, there's a tension there between what is said and what is depicted that can be mined and should be mined in the service of the show's central themes, which are memory. And in this show, motivation depends on narrative. And I find that that's very true in life, too. You know, you never meet a villain who thinks they're the villain. Their narrative ends with them somehow the beleaguered hero, right?
Right.
And so, in a way, this is a story about the effect of stories, and not just from a religious or philosophical point of view, but the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, who we are.
You're dealing with truth-telling here, which
yes.
is reflected in the title of your show,
Thank
True
you
Detective.
Very much. Thank you. Yes.
I mean, and truth at several levels. I mean, there's the search for the true killer. There's truth and honesty in personal relationships. You know, there's how we tell a story, whether the stories we tell are true. And I mean, the suggestion is we're kind of always fudging the truth to some degree.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think the suggestion that I was going for in the final execution was that, you know, it's all through a glass darkly, isn't it? As much as we might try to strip ourselves of illusions, what you're ultimately left with is the exact poverty of your knowledge, that you know very little about your situation as a human being on the planet Earth. And what you do know sounds like a noir story.
Yeah.
You're doomed. You were born into a death sentence and you didn't ask for it, and this only ends one way, right?
Well, I have to ask you about Rust Cole, one of your two main characters, played brilliantly by Matthew McConaughey in the series.
Yes.
He's some kind of combination of master criminal investigator and interrogator and existential philosopher. And, you know, I got the impression that he's the one character who's willing to stare straight into the face of the absurdity of life without blinking. But he's also haunted. I mean, he's haunted by personal tragedy,
yeah.
by sort of constantly living at the edge of despair. I mean, I've never seen another television character like him before. Where did you get the idea for this character?
Well, he was real close under the skin. You know, when Russ started talking, there was never much hesitation between keystrokes, you know.
There's a lot of you in Rust.
In his intolerances, the things he is intolerant of, I would say so. I mean, in a way, there's various means by which I was working out a lot of personal subjects, which is what I do in my fiction, too. And in a way, you know, I both men were representative of two different kinds of bad roads I could have imagined myself on. But, I you know, I find Cole admirable. At the end of the day, I think I think his tragic flaw is that, you know, he has a huge blind spot like everyone else does when it comes to himself.
Mm-hmm.
But You know, I've said before that he's certainly not a nihilist. He'd be the most unsuccessful nihilist in history. If anything, everything is overwrought with meaning for Cole. You know, he's hypersensitive. We find out he has synesthesia. And in that way, what he's talking about in the first episode, when you're meditating on the idea of your own crucifixion, is that for him to wake up and encounter the world and do this job is a form of self-crucifixion, because he's so extremely sensitive. And his use of this kind of Frankenstein homegrown antinatalist philosophy strikes me frequently as defensive, to the point he protests too much. You know, his complaints aren't very different from Job's complaints. Yeah. And Job's complaint was that he was a character in a story and he didn't like how the story was being told, right? So you have to ask, you know, who's Cole complaining to?
Well, and you have clearly read your Nietzsche and Samuel Beckett here. I mean, you seem to be steeped in this stuff.
Those are my guys.
Yeah, they're my guys too. Yes. I loved Russ Cole, I have to
Thank
say.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, you know, and it's also like, once you start thinking about the character of the hard-boiled detective, it lends itself to sort of the origins of hard-boiled thought, period. You know, and that's a short jump to Schopenhauer and Nietzsche.
Well, and I mean, you've talked about being haunted by growing up in the South, the landscape, and all
Very
that.
Much.
I mean, there's also being metaphysically haunted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as much as you can be, even as a child, I was. I came from a heavily religious family that did a lot of worship. I never bought that stuff for a second. I mean, even at 5 years old, and it was always a source of real angst and real tension.
But it sounds like you didn't just dismiss it either, though. I mean, somehow that seeped into your bones.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, I'm not religious in any way, and you know, Cole's very cautious optimism at the end does not indicate any kind of afterlife or in any kind of finding God moment. You know, I don't believe in that stuff. But at the same time, I'm unwilling to take any hardline stance about something I don't know about. So I don't trust believers on either end of the spectrum, because they tend to be avoiding the nuances of the situation.
So what do you think it is that keeps Russ Cole going? I mean, he has this kind of bleak view of existence, but he's also, I mean, he wants to get to the truth. He wants to solve the crime.
Well, you know, he says in episode one, he lacks the constitution for suicide. I think that's true. And I think he lives through duty. I think one of the things I think is most admirable about him, to me at least, is that he has this very rigid code of honor that no one gave him, that seems to sit outside of the culture. That's why he's an oddball with the other police officers, because his code of honor has nothing to do with their cultural contexts.
Right. He doesn't want to just be the good old boy. I mean,
he has no interest in servicing any kind of social agenda. And his job allows him a pursuit of the truth, which can organize the other facets of his life. So, you know, one of the interesting dichotomies between the two men is that the one man has literally nothing governing him, and he keeps himself rigidly self-governed. And the one that has a family and should be more governed uses that as an excuse to go ungoverned.
Right. And the other character, Marty Hart, keeps talking about, you know, family is what keeps you on the straight and narrow. But of course, he screws it all up, and you have the sense that actually family's not the thing that keeps him going.
No, or at least not the thing that he should have attached himself to, is how I would look at it. Because I do think the Marty in 2012 is different than the Marty from 1995 or 2002. Is it episode 5 when he says he returns to that old saying about the detective's curse and how he was paying attention to all the wrong things? That infidelity is one kind of sin, but his true failure was inattention. I think that shows a significant personal growth that he can look at himself that way. And the way that he says goodbye to Maggie.
His wife.
Yeah, I do think he's very regretful of the choices he made, and he sees that he had attached himself to the wrong thing. But you know, human beings, we often attach ourselves to the wrong things because we're at the subject of so many whims and desires that we don't always know what to want. You know, a fear you're getting older and that you can actually see the end of the tunnel now might lead someone to step outside their marriage or act rashly in a way they wouldn't, you know, because suddenly their motivations have changed. The narrative has changed for them. Yeah. So you need to be careful what stories you tell yourself is sort of the common sin between Rust and Marty.
Do you think True Detective is different than other shows on television? I mean, even HBO shows?
You know, I think that's something I should leave for other people to say. Most of the feedback I've gotten has been really touching and gratifying. But there's also people that think it's total genre trash. So I don't know.
Well, there is. I mean,
I think it probably traffics in ambiguity more than some of the other shows I've seen. But, you know, my concerns are my concerns, and I can't speak to other creators' concerns.
Well, I mean, and structurally, it's pretty unusual. I mean, you have a phenomenal amount of creative control here. I mean, you were the sole writer of all the episodes in season one. You're the, you know, the showrunner. I mean, you determine the story arc. You're an executive producer.
The scripts, I was talking about this to an executive the other day, and the scripts we figured out probably equaled about 30% of my job.
Sounds like a huge amount of work, for one thing.
Well, yeah, but it's spread over a year and a half, so.
I mean, the amazing part of the story is, I mean, you were not a known Hollywood commodity when you started doing it. I mean, you had written one novel, and somehow you got all of this creative control.
Well, you know, I did come into town with six scripts that got me a lot of jobs, and I think that should be really heartening to people, you know? I had never tried to make a jump into this field because it seemed like there were so many class and financial and geographic boundaries between me and it. And then what I learned was, you know, if you come in with good work, they don't want to keep good talent out. That's a total myth of the entertainment industry. They want to monetize talent and bring it in. You know, so when I got out here, I was offered a lot of jobs and took a few, did a couple episodes of The Killing, which was, for all intents and purposes, a really great TV school in the sense that I got to learn production and see what everything entailed and be on set and see what a showrunner needs to do. And so then afterwards, it probably had more to do with how we packaged it. And even then, I think if my work had been unsatisfactory, I would have been the easiest guy in the world to get rid of. You know, famous showrunners get fired. Like they could have put me on a plane and nobody would have heard a word about it.
Well, I'm also wondering if you came along at the right time. I mean, I don't think television used to be like this 20 years ago. And I mean, this is a very literary show that you have written and it's found an audience.
Yeah, that was strange. The finding the audience part. I don't know. You know, it might be a combination of those things. One of my first jobs when I got to Hollywood was I had a blind pilot deal with HBO. That pilot ended up not getting made, but I worked with them for a year developing it. So they got to know me and they got to see what I was like and whether I was a serious person and what kind of work I did. So that might have given them more confidence at the time we pitched the show. It was the right combination of elements.
Part of what I think is so fascinating about your story is, I mean, essentially you are working as what I would describe as an auteur. I mean, sort of the master creative presence, and yet you're working in a medium that is highly collaborative. I mean, usually it's thought of as a whole bunch of script writers and multiple directors. I mean, there's just one director for all of your season one and, you know, various other executive producers. And I mean, here you are this dominant creative presence.
Yeah, like I said, I think you earn your credibility by your performance. I'm trying to figure out how to frame the auteur collaboration thing. Yeah, any film or television any kind of filmed entertainment is a totally collaborative medium, and it involves hundreds of people doing great jobs. But the reason I went towards television as opposed to film right now is because the writer's in control in television until it becomes apparent they shouldn't be in control. So
if you're a serious writer, it's better to go to television than to film.
Absolutely. And if you ask me, I think that's one of the reasons television for at least the last 15 years has been much dramatically richer than film. Because in film, the writer is largely divorced from the process when they go to make the movie. And with True Detective, you know, I'm on set the entire time. I'm working with the actors on set. I have creative approval over everything from incidental background dressing to doing my own edits of the episodes. And so I approached it from the point of view of you know, this was going to be as personal and dense and layered as I would do a novel. And my hero, I guess, for that sort of television was always Dennis Potter. Dennis Potter never used a writing room. And
I'm trying to think of what television Dennis Potter...
The Singing Detective.
Okay, sure.
Pennies from Heaven with Bob Hoskins.
Right.
Lipstick on Your Collar with Ewan McGregor. Karaoke Cold Lazarus. Just a ton of stuff. But they were all very novelistic in their layering of theme and character and detail. And they did things that for which television is best suited. You know, the singing detective isn't as good as a movie, isn't good as a movie, and it isn't good as a novel. It needs to be a 6-episode television show. Same thing with Pennies from Heaven, I think, and the other stuff he did. So he, to me, was the television auteur that I found really inspiring. It wasn't until that first wave of great HBO shows and when coverage of showrunners actually started that I realized such an experience might be possible on American television.
Yeah. Now, it's worth pointing out that you not only have created this TV show, I mean, you are also a published fiction writer. I mean, you've written short stories, you wrote a novel, Galveston. So I'm wondering what it's like to, I mean, what the similarities and differences are between mm-hmm. working in these two very different media. I mean, you know, publishing books and making TV shows.
Well, the primary thing is that one of those things has an audience and the other two don't. So I noticed that right away. I was really approaching this more like I approach fiction, which is that, you know, I never expect to be a bestseller. And for me, writing and creating is too difficult and cathartic to expend on some kind of service industry where I'm just trying to guess what people want and give it to them. I've found that it's great for me because you have the solitary, monastic, interior existence of actually writing the words on the page. And I write very detailed scripts. I mean, lengthy descriptions, the same as in my prose. And I do stage direction and camera angles and everything. So I treat my scripts as a literary document. And then it's like after you've written the novel, you get to hand it off to these wonderful, talented people who are going to make it come alive and realize it. I mean, the experience of having a great actor say your words and deliver a great performance is incredible. It's something I wish every writer, every prose writer, every poet could experience because it's incredibly gratifying to see other professionals take your work and run with it. You know, to take the description you started with and to add and enhance and bring their own talents and sensibilities to it. So you get the interior monastic life of the novelist or the prose writer, but then you get to go join the circus for 9 months, which for me is really good. I mean, I tend to go batty. I write in long stretches and I tend to be pretty batty when I come out of it.
So as a writer, which do you like more, writing TV scripts or writing a novel?
Well, I love them both for different reasons, you know, and I love writing scripts to the extent that I can control the finished product. You know, I've done film scripts before where I understand that, you know, I shouldn't get emotionally invested in this because I'm going to hand it off. This is just a job. But the love comes from being able to realize a vision. And I think it's just two different types. It's just two different forms. I don't distinguish between playwriting and novel writing and short story writing and script writing personally. You know, I'm creating. I'm working with those 26 letters of the alphabet.
Has the experience of writing TV scripts, has that changed the way you approach writing fiction?
You know, I think I am a better fiction writer now for having written so many scripts and done so much in drama. I've been messing around with some plays recently too, because the theater and TV drama to a lesser extent brings everything down to character and action. And that's a very good thing for a novelist to remember. They're learning to write a scene so that it plays dramatically is a great benefit. And I would be more confident now in tackling larger stories, larger, more complicated stories.
Now, the other thing I have to ask you about is the setting of True Detective, which is also similar to the setting of your novel Galveston. I mean, it's set in the South. I mean, mm-hmm. True Detective.
It's almost the exact same setting.
And we see oil rigs offshore. We see a lot of pictures of the working poor. The backdrop is there. I mean, it's almost like another character in the series.
Yes.
Why is the land so important to you?
Thank you for noticing that. And we always did consider the landscape to be the third lead in the show. Landscape has just always affected me on a sensory, personal level a great deal. And growing up in these areas, I always felt the landscape was almost oppressive to me. It was so flat, and all the trees had been cut down. And the only thing on the horizons was a refinery pumping smoke into the sky. These things were as much a part of me as my personal tastes, I think. And so if we're talking about how we shape the world and how the world shapes us, I think it was really appropriate to dwell on the landscape. And, you know, Henry James said, landscape is character. And I've always felt that way. Where somebody is going to affect who they are, and who they are is going to affect where they are.
So did you want to escape this environment that you grew up with? I mean, so familiar? Or
I did.
Yeah,
I did. And it was interesting to me that I couldn't ever really write about it till I had been gone for a while. I mean, I wasn't really tackling these things that had made such an impression on me in my earliest writings. That was something that came back to me as I began to realize what my true subjects were, I guess. But yeah, as a young person, I very much wanted to escape, and I had no means. And even after college, you know, I lived for 4 years in Texas and then went to grad school, so I didn't get that far away. But coming back to it and living there for 10 months and making this show, it was an intensely personal experience, yeah.
Well, I get the sense that your characters are kind of trapped in mm-hmm. this landscape. I mean, you got out, but you keep writing about it.
Well,
but
yeah.
your characters don't get out.
Well, yeah. And we're all trapped. And the first thing that traps us is our ego, which separates us from the rest of the world and makes us think that we're all a bunch of different things instead of one thing. And then the cages just sort of multiply from there, right? You have a series of personal cages, defenses, illusions, predilections, narratives. And then you lay on top of that the narratives of family, the narratives of God and country. And this is before you even get to the landscape, mind you. And then the landscape with its economic depression and its lack of upward mobility and its lack of opportunities can be oppressive.
Do you feel like you're still in a cage?
Yeah, sure, of course. I mean, I imagine I'll feel like that until I pass away, and then I won't feel anything. but yeah, there's always a this kind of metaphysical dog nipping at your heels, you know? And it's not even that you're not there anymore. It's that it will always live inside you, and it will never go away. Where you come from will always live inside you. And you need to be careful not to hate that place.
Speaking of passing away and those metaphysical questions, I have to ask you something about the very end of the last episode.
Sure.
Now, you said that, you know, you don't believe in God, you don't believe in an afterlife, but it sure seems like Rust Cole is describing a near-death experience he's had with some contact with
Absolutely.
The beyond.
Absolutely. But I don't think he's having contact with beyond. I mean, everything Rust Cole says happens to him could happen within the confines of his own brain, right? In inside of a coma, because technically what he's describing is a darkness where he still had a sense of self. And the only, and he could feel his sense of self fading. And what was taking its place for a short time was the remembrance of love. And then in that remembrance of love, he could still feel himself and the love fading away. And until there was nothingness, he says, I disappeared. I was gone. And then I woke up. So I think he did have he definitely had a near-death experience, but it didn't involve contact with anything supernatural. What it involved was the emotional memory of love that, on top of everything he had been through, allowed Cole for the first time to access the very deep grief that sat at the heart of all his hardness, and that had been there since he was a child. You know, if you pay attention to Rust's sort of origin story, you know, he was the unwanted child of a single mother who dumped him off on a survivalist Vietnam vet who took him to Alaska to live off the land, joins the army as soon as he gets a chance, goes from there to law enforcement. This is before he lost his daughter and things went really bad. This is a man who probably in most ways has never really known love. So he hasn't been converted at all. I believe he's had his perception widened maybe 5% to admit that the hardline pessimism he was taking was no more definitive than anyone else's narrative, perhaps. And the optimism he expresses is a very cautious one, because I don't think there's anything to suggest that Cole's optimism is more valid than his pessimism. Just that they're both narratives. And the stars are fading at the end.
It's fascinating to hear the creator of this describing this, because a viewer might come to some different conclusions.
Oh, I know. I've been really careful not to do too many of these things, because you get sucked in to a conversation, like a wider conversation I never wanted to have, yeah. You know, based on someone's misreading.
Yeah. So one final question. Can you give us any hints as to season two of True Detective?
Well, right now we're working with three leads, and it takes place in California, not Los Angeles, but some of the much lesser known venues of California. And we're going to try to capture a certain psychosphere ambiance of the place, much like we did in season one. And the characters are all new, but I'm deeply in love with each of them. And we've got the entire series broken out with a couple scripts, and we'll probably start casting in earnest within the coming month.
Well, I can't wait.
Well, thanks very much. Thank you.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.